Well, Professor Dutta, thank you very much. As you just told you, we've been friends for a very long time. We were young once, we're getting old now. I'm getting older than he is. Somehow the trajectories aren't quite overlapping. It is really a good fortune to be here and to be introduced by him, because who would have thought 35 years back that such a situation would arise, you know? And there is therefore a lot of advantages in every decade of your growth. I decided to study this issue of town and country because I realized that much of what I knew about India was to a large extent colored by what others told me about it. And most of my early years, when I was your age and a little beyond that, we were tutored into Indian society by some very famous people who read and researched extensively on rural India, urban India, family, kinship, caste, and everything else. And as I grew older and began to do my own work on the subject, I faced a bit of a problem, and I'm sure you'll face it too. And the problem really was that I didn't quite know how to handle what I had learned, because much of what I had learned had become quite irrelevant, you know, because the society was changing so rapidly. It was not as if that didn't help me to understand what I saw around me, but if I were to embrace just that and delve deeply into only that, then I think that much of what's going on around us would have escaped me. To some extent, I'd say that I've been very fortunate because on many occasions I've had access to material, literature, people, places that were quite fortuitous. They normally don't happen. This has been my good fortune that I've been able to access that kind of resource. And in other ways, I'd also say that I've also been lucky because while I was teaching in the JNU, I was able to travel quite a bit. And I have met with extraordinary camaraderie, friendship from many people, students and teachers alike. And when I talked about these things with my colleagues, they often came up with suggestions which I benefited from. And they also opposed me in a number of ways, and I enjoyed that kind of swordsmanship with them. This, every paper, every research work, I think requires some provocation. You can't really do research without provocation. Someone must provoke you into saying something or doing something. You must be angry about something. As a professor of mine said, and the history of economics professor Oberoi said, that unless someone really hurts you, unless you want to really fight about something, you really can't do research. You can't research with a calm and contented frame of mind. There has to be if not a fire in your belly, as he said, there should be anger in your liver. You know, this is a Hindi phrase, I'm translating it not very well, but there you are. So there were two kinds of provocation that really got me going on this subject. One was, I might call the census shock. By census, I mean the census we hold every 10 years. You know, the 2011 census reports are just about coming out. Can you hear me well or not?
Yeah.
And the other is what I would call the audit shock. The auditors do audit. I was an auditor for some years, another piece of good fortune. And these two shocks, I put them together, and this is what I got. I'll be talking to you about that. The census shock happened in the following way. I was working on villages in West UP, basically understanding the new kind of mobilization amongst farmers in West UP. And then I came back to my university, which was then JNU. And I was sitting in a lecture, some of my colleagues were delivering a paper on West UP and on the relationship between big and small farmer and so forth. And there they discussed at some length about the role of agricultural labor and also the elements of bonded labor in West UP. So when they said all this, I was a bit surprised, because I had just come back from there and I did not really see that many agricultural laborers and I did not see any bonded labor. But here there were very eminent people discussing agricultural labor and bonded labor in UP, and I asked them where they got the data from, and they say, but of course the census. that's where we got the data from. And then they said, we have tweaked it further by looking to the National Sample Survey. So I began to look at the census very carefully, and I found that either I was dreadfully wrong, or there's something happening in the Census Bureau which wasn't making any sense to me. So what I did then, as part of my census shock, what I did then was I zeroed in on three villages which were in the region I was studying. You know, you have something called the District Census Handbook. Have you ever heard of that? District Census Handbook, villages are, recorded. The statistics and profile of villages. So I found three villages which were recorded in the District Census Handbook, all three of them in Muzaffarnagar. And I looked at them and I said, okay, I'm going to do my own census of these three villages. So I went door to door. One village I did on my own entirely, and the other two villages I did with the help of two friends of mine. I mean, they've become friends. It's because of the generosity of the heart. They were earlier my students, and we became friends, and they helped me. So these three villages we did, door to door. And then we found that our figures and the figures of the census are wide variation, not 5%, 2%, 3%, but at one particular village, about 44% variation. And this was absolutely unacceptable. And I know I did it myself, so I know this is true, what I had with me. So then we went across to the block development officer, the BDO, his office, and we asked him, well, could you please explain this to us? Why are we so wrong? And the census says this, and we say this. We don't find agricultural laborers, but your census finds 43%, 47%, 38% agricultural laborers. So where are these agricultural laborers? So we sat down with the BDO, and we had the names here, and he had his file here. And I said, Ram Prasad, oh, he's dead. So Kumar is gone to Bombay. So I said, but how were they recorded as agricultural laborers? So either the census enumerator was having a good time with the BDO in his office and making up stories, or he had made an elementary error which he was warned against during the training program. And the error is this, that if somebody does not own land in a village, it does not automatically make him a landless agricultural laborer. You see, you may not own land, but you may not be an agricultural laborer. And this is the most generous interpretation I can give as to why there were so many agricultural laborers mentioned in the census and why that didn't figure in my recording. And I did a very faithful recording, believe me. And I, in fact, published one village figures, in my book. The rest of it and I also said that, should you want more data, I can give them all to you. But anyway, that was there, so I thought I'd put it on record that, this was the problem. So I then began to look at the census figures very carefully, and I began to look at the National Sample Survey figures carefully. And then I found that something else was going on, and that is the definition of a farmer. In my view, the numbers of farmers that we have in either the census or the National Sample Survey, which is a much more, shall we say, respectable organization, because it is done on the edges of the National Sample Survey Office organization, which is, pretty high-powered, and they have important intellectuals heading these organizations. And so the figures, the figures of the National Sample Survey is, again, in my view, far too excessive when it comes to farmers. And then I realized why. Because if you look at the National Sample Survey, and if you have any computer laptop right here, you could tap National Sample Survey, look at the chapter on definitions, and you'll find that the definition of farmer is anyone who tills his land, her land, somebody else's land, but tills land, is a farmer during the past 365 days, which is 1 year, right? So what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that is the word during, not for. So if it's during the past 365 days, it doesn't really mention how many days that man should be working in the year. He could be working for 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, maybe a few days, who knows, right? But it is during. And because it is during, the numbers of farmers are so large. But if you were to ask a more pointed question, how many days do you really farm in a year, I think you would have a very different picture. And this I learned soon enough, because my early days of field working in villages were in some ways tempered by this census shock. So I used to ask people, well, what do you do? And they say, well, you know, I'm a farmer. And I used to say, okay, you're a farmer. And then later on in the evening, I asked them, well, what did you do? Not what do you do, but what did you do? So they say things like, well, you know, today I was did some earth moving. I did some carpentry, did some masonry, did some brickwork, did some coolie work, you know, rickshaw pulling, whatever it is. So I said, but you told me you're a farmer? He said, yeah, but I'm a farmer. Then I realized that, you know, it was very interesting that he wasn't lying that he was a farmer. I wasn't lying when I put it down as that he's a farmer. But actually, he is not farming most of the time. But farming is the only job he really knows. You see, that's why he calls himself a farmer.
Identity. His identity is farmer.
Yeah, because he can read the skies, he can tell the clouds, he can tell you how much moisture there is in the soil, and the breezes are blowing in a certain direction, what does that mean, you know? He can tell all of that, but he only has a handkerchief-sized plot, and that plot will not engage him for the day, you know? So he has to go out and look for work. So what does he do usually? He gets up in the morning, takes a lunch pail, and he bends his knees towards the bus stop or the village square, where he hopes that some contractor will come, catch his eye, and take him up for the day, and give him a job to do. If he's lucky, it'll be for 2 days. If he's lucky, it's still 1 week, whatever it is, you know? So that's the way it is. So very often they come back disappointed, and some days they get something, you know, going. In fact, you don't have to go very far. If you go to any major place in Delhi, you'll find so many of these people who cluster in the morning waiting for a contractor to pick them up, you know, and then they are hired for the day, for the hour or whatever it is. And then I also learned the other mistake I used to make was a terminological error. I used to often ask people things like, do you have a nokri? You know, and they say, no, we don't have a nokri. And then they tell me about the fact that they were carpenters or welders or whatever it is. And then I realized the word I should have used is mazduri. You know, do you do mazduri? Because mazduri is what they do, which is when they're paid by the hour. When you say nokri in many places in India, when you use the word nokri or equivalence of that in any other language, they usually think of a regular paid job for a month or so. You know, that becomes a nokri. Everything else is more or less mazduri. So this was a census shock that made me sit up and say, well, listen, what you read in published figures may not always be true. So you have to get a sense of what is right and wrong by having a feel of that region. You must be there, have a feel, have a sense of it. Then and only then can you accept figures, read between the lines or between the columns or whatever is the phrase, and come to a realistic understanding of what things are, especially keeping in mind the fact that your research is supposed to be one which is finely granulated in terms of field experience. So when we talk about quality and quantity and quantitative research, this is the way I look at it. Unless you have quality that informs quantity, it isn't good enough. You know, you have to have quality that informs, corrects, modulates, calibrates quantity. And then you have the best of quality and quantity. And the reason why this mixture is important is sometimes you can have an observation which may be corrected by some quantitative studies. On the other hand, there may be some quantitative figures which need to be corrected because of your observation. You see? So why not? Why not use them synergetically and usefully, and I'm sure with a great degree of profitability. So this is the way I look at figures nowadays. You know, I've become rather paranoid about it, but that's the way it is. So this is the first census shock. Now, the other business is audit shop, because I was for many years in the corporate world as a partner in a multinational firm called KPMG. And I started a division on forensic accounting and business practices, whatever. So in that division, we used to go around auditing. And we had many clients who ask us to audit not only the financial part, but what is happening behind the documents. So when we go to these firms, and we'd enter, you know, it was wonderful because they manicured lawns, you know, polished cars in front, polished people stepping out, talking to you in, you know, very cultivated tones, using words that are straight out of business school, like let's syndicate an opinion, you know, what are the dashboard of opportunities, you know, things like that. They're all very impressive. So you go through all of that, and, you know, there's no reason why you should see anything wrong in that. But when you go past the front door and past the front offices into the rear of, you know, parts of the establishment, things don't look so good anymore. Then we realized that maybe what we were doing wrong was we were just going in there announcing ourselves in advance, like good, well-mannered people, you know. I'm coming to your house at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, you know. So they're all ready for me. And we thought that, you know, what we should do is to go unannounced, not tell them we are coming. And of course, our clients who were paying for us, they were usually Europeans, and they thought that was a dreadful thing to do, you know, invasion of privacy and so forth, but we insisted upon it. And when we did it, a new world opened up, a completely new world. So when we used to suddenly come into the gates, there'd be panic. The guard would be very hostile to us. He wouldn't let us in till he talked to his boss. And we could see from the corner of our eye, people were running out to the back gates, you know. So then we decided that from now on, we're going to position young, nimble-footed auditors in the rear exit. So before we'd come in for the main exit, we'd do a recce of the joint and see what are the other exits and position people there. So as we'd enter from this main gate into this beautiful lawn, you know, shiny people, and you see people running off the back gates. That was because most of these workers were actually not registered. They were all what you might call loosely informal labor. And you wouldn't imagine there were so many informal laborers, because if you have a look at the factory, you think that this place is just meant for organized sector production. And yet, hundreds would run away. If it was a very big factory, hundreds would run away. If it was a smaller factory, scores would run away. You know? And every time we asked them what was the reason, these guys came up with some convoluted explanation. In some parts of West UP, they say this is namaz time and they're running, you know, which is hardly namaz time. You can't have namaz every hour, or something else is happening. And they just concoct these stories. So that is when I realized the incidence of informal labor in the formal sector. You see, I didn't quite realize till then. And had I not gone there as an auditor, I would never have known. Because if I were to go there as an academic, I wouldn't get entry. But because I'm an auditor, you can't turn me down. I have to go. I've got the client behind me. You know, I've got his letter. And if you don't let me in, you're in trouble. So not only could I get in, I could also read their books. I could also ask for papers. I could also snoop in their drawers. And that's what we used to do. And, you know, something else was waiting for us to be excavated, as it were, which was not there in plain sight. So then I put the two together and asked myself, where are these informal laborers coming from? Where are they coming from after all? There's so many of them. And why is it that these informal laborers are important? Why can't they have organized labor? Why can't they have trained labor? Why do they have these semi-skilled, unskilled laborers, you know, by the dozens, by the scores, sometimes by the hundreds? So why is that so? So when I put the two together, a story that emerges is as follows, that the poor people, in order to stay poor and get better off than just being poor, need rich people who are very rich, who need the poor people to stay rich. You know, that is the relationship. It is not one which is at the obvious level of contradiction, but of a kind of dependence. So to be rich, you need the poor. You can't get rich on your own. And to be urban, you need the rural. You can't be urban on your own. And this is the burden of my song, which I'm trying to, you know, relate to you. So then I've said that the secret must lie in rural India, because that is where the informal workers are coming from. Because, you know, we used to interview these people, where are you from? And they'd all be from different parts of the world, of the country. They'd be from Panipat, from Bhadohi, Jaunpur, Mirzapur. I spent a lot of time in these three districts. Or from parts of Jharkhand, where Latihar, Lohardaga, where also was one of my areas of research. So they'd come from all these places, sometimes from Kishanganj, North Bihar, Sarsa. So, and then they'd go all over the country. You know, poor people I found, poor villages I found, were extreme risk takers. They should take risk of the kind that you and I would hesitate to, you know. Extreme risk takers, really. You know, they don't know where they're going, except that they have a relation somewhere there who's called them and they're going there. Other than that, it's basically a prayer and a song, you know. They're taking off, hoping for the best. So this is how you have these poor people running, from leaving their villages and going distant places. Till 2002, I rarely found a North Indian worker in South India. But I don't know what happened around that time. Maybe the numbers of workers in North India just increased phenomenally. But after 2002, you know, all over South India, Coimbatore, for example, you know, Tirupur, you know, have you heard of Tirupur? Tirupur is a place where they make these vests and shirts and socks and stuff, you know, which is the, they say, the hosiery capital of India, perhaps of the world. You find people from all over, from Bihar, from Jharkhand, everywhere, Kishanganj, you know, right up there, Kishanganj, they come down to Tirupur. So workers are, as I told you earlier, extremely adventurous people. They go anywhere, and they'll go anywhere. And this is the interesting part. So, in other words, we have to look at the village carefully. What is the village doing that is expelling so many people, you know, every day? What's going on? So, as I told you at this point, my initial reluctance to accept what I had learned in classrooms came alive. Because if you look at the figures from 1960, let us say, roughly, from 1960 to 2005 or so, what do you find? You find that when India became independent around that time, roughly 53%, 50.1% of our GDP was agriculture. In 1960, when India became independent, it was higher. It was almost 66%. You know, by 1960, it became 53%. Then if you look at the freshly minted figures now, you know, fresh from the mint, as it were, it is only 13.9%. So the contribution of agriculture to our GDP is going down drastically, you know, over the years. And this is amazing. You had, you know, something like, you won't believe this, you had 2 lakh pump sets in 1960, and by 2005, you had 25 million pump sets, you know, the jump. Then at that time, again, used less than 1 million tons of fertilizer. Today, it is almost 28 million tons of fertilizer. But interestingly enough, the amount of land that is cropped hasn't grown by much, from 45 million hectares to about 46.2 million hectares. But all of this increase has happened because cropping has increased 3 times, multiple cropping particularly, has increased 3 times. So a lot of pressure on the land, right? Now that is one part of the story. The other part of the story is the fact about the textbooks. How relevant were they? So if you look at the figures again, from 1970 this time, to 2004-5, after which I don't have the figures yet, they are about to come, you'll find some interesting things. You know, when I used to go to these villages, whether it is in West UP or East UP or Bihar, and I've studied quite a few areas, and this came up with a census shock, by the way, this issue as well. I rarely came across a big landlord, you know, and I grew up with this, host of literature which told us about big landlords and poor landowners and serf and tenants and the rest of the sharecroppers and all that. I saw some of it years ago in the 70s, but I wasn't really working on villages at that time. I became interested in villages around 84, 85. So I really didn't find that many big landlords. In fact, it was very difficult to find a big landlord of the style, the kind that I had been told about in my books. And seen in movies like many of the Benegal films, you know, big landlord riding a horse, whipping people, you know, burning villages. So by the time I began to study villages, something had happened, obviously changes had occurred. And then when I looked carefully at the figures, I found indeed the changes occurred. This is the quality quantity business. The changes had occurred because, you know, there was a time in India when 78% of land of farmers were working in one form or the other for big landlords. That was the case long years ago. But now what we find is that the figure has dropped drastically. 30.8% of the land was owned by big landlords. Today it is only 11.8%. You know, big landlords till 1960, they constituted 3.8% of the rural population. Today is only 0.8%. If you take areas like Bihar and Bengal, the numbers of big landlords are below decimal, you know, 0.2%, 0.3%. In Rajasthan and Punjab, it is higher, 7% and 8%, but not that much more. Not like the stories we had heard about big landlords. So that is a thing which we have to pay attention to. Instead, what we see is the rise of what? Of marginal farmers. Marginal farmers are growing, you know, rapidly, numbers of marginal farmers, because large number of middle farmers are now becoming marginal farmers. Now, why is this happening? It's happening because of demographic pressure. Why demographic pressure? Because with the increase in family size, land holdings are being subdivided. And because they're being subdivided, what was once a fairly large plot of land is now becoming a small plot of land. You know, so the subdivision is happening. When I was studying West UP, I met this Jat peasant leaders and Gujar peasant leaders. The Jat peasant leader, Mahendra Singh Tikayat, you may have heard of him, he's just passed away. So Mahendra Singh Tikayat, when I met him in the 81 in the first round, the movement hadn't yet begun. I had met him, however, and he and his friends used to make fun of me. They said that, you know, look at you, skinny, pigeon-chested, you know, no good. Look at his shoulders. And look at us. We are big, tall, strong. We are so handsome, you know. We feed India. We protect India. And he was full of starch, right? He was very, very proud of himself and of his children and his family and the fact that they were real agriculturalists, you know, who plowed the land. And they said, look at our hands and look at your hands. Look at our shoulders and your shoulders. Look at our chest and your chest. You know, so different. And besides, as I said earlier, we are the salt of the earth and you people are really effete snobs who don't deserve to be around. But by the time 1990 came, you know, it was such a surprise because this same man had lost his ramrod straight posture. He was almost like a supplicant. He was keen that his sons work for me as my flunkies, somehow get them out of land. Because what had happened was that by that time he inherited about 14 acres of land, and he had three grown-up boys and two of them had married. And there was a great pressure on the land, and he wanted them out of the land. And this process was happening right across. Maybe in the first few years they were in denial. By the time 1990 came around, there was no room for denial anyway. But what I also found during that phase is that rural net domestic income, you know, 45.5% of that, this statistic was produced in 1996 and not been done since. This is National Account Statistics. But 45.5% of rural net domestic income was not agricultural. So a village economy, well, almost half of it was not rural at all. And if you were to look at it today, I'm sure the number will be much greater than that. But 45.5%, 1996, 45.5% of rural net domestic product was not agriculture. Village India, half of village India economy then, roughly, was not agricultural at all. And then if you look at the figures since then, of, say, share of employment, you'll find that from 1993 to 2010, there's been a huge jump, you know. For example, the village India today produces roughly 46% of all manufactured goods in the country as a whole, you know, from 22%. Huge jump. Now, how did this happen? Why is it happening? This is happening in village India. So you have to now take into account the fact that if you were to describe a village according to official criteria, you would have number of persons per square kilometer, one criterion. Number two criterion would be whether it has a town council, municipality hall, etc., etc. The third criterion, which is the most important one in my view, is that 75% of all adult males should be working on agriculture. Right? That's what makes a rural area rural area. But if you see what's happening on the ground, when 45.5% of rural economy is not agricultural, almost every village will be disqualified as a village. If you were to only pick on the economic criterion, that very, very few villages actually are full-time agricultural villages. Very few village households are full-time agricultural households. A large number of people in village India are actually in what they call rural non-farm employment, RNFE, rural non-farm employment, and that number is growing rapidly. In a place like Bihar, for example, there's 63% of rural households are in rural non-farm employment. But you know, very often this fact is not captured, because in the National Sample Survey, they say, who is a farmer? Anyone who does this and the other, who tills land during the past 365 days? That was not good enough, obviously. But what makes patterns worse is, what is a farmer's household? And you know how the National Sample Survey defines that? A farmer's household is any household which has one such person. So you may be a doctor, engineer, professor, and one of you is a farmer who farms for 1 month a year, and that becomes a farmer's household. Why was this done? I don't know. Maybe just for the ease of the enumerator, you know? It'd be easy to enumerate. Anybody in the household farm? Yes, tick, you know, farmer's household. Otherwise, it makes no sense. But if you take another view at it, you'll find that when you look at the rural non-farm employment pictures of the same organization called National Sample Survey, a new world emerges. So the two wings of the National Sample Survey are obviously not talking to each other. You know, one is pronouncing that many number of farmers, and the other one is talking about rural non-farm employment, which is very high. There are many households that are not actually rural households because of rural non-farm employment. So these two are not working together. But the basic thing that as we are working in a comprehensive fashion, we have to take that on board and then understand the fact that today in rural India, much of rural India's economy is not actually agricultural anymore. There is a figure in the census, a table in the census called houses and the uses to which they are put or something like that. And there you find, you know, houses, some houses are used as dwellings, some as temples, some as schools. But there's one category called workshops, worksheds. And that number is absolutely impressive. The number of houses in village India that are used as workshops, worksheds. You know, in other words, small informal industries are all across village India, everywhere. You know, and these workshop worksheds are there. And if you think the people who work in the workshop, workshops are doing it part-time, or that's just the women are working after cooking and looking after children, you're wrong. The poorer the area, the more the workshops, workshop, which is absolutely fantastic, you know. You would think that in an area which is prosperous like West UP, there'd be more workshops, worksheds. But actually it is East UP where there are more workshops and worksheds. You would think that women predominate in these workshops, worksheds. No. The poorer the area, the more the men that work in these places. In UP, 6 times more men than women work in these sheds. In Rajasthan, unbelievable 10 times more men than women work in this area, in these workshops, worksheds. You know? And what are they doing? They're doing everything that you can imagine. All that they're doing actually is putting us in the international market as far as globalization is concerned. 11% of the world's trade in carpets, and I'm not joking, in 2008, after that world's trade in carpets, India's contribution has gone down significantly. But in 2008, 11% of the world's trade in carpets began and ended, you know where? In 3 districts of UP. Bhadohi, Jaunpur, Mirzapur. 3 districts of UP. And what kind of carpets were they? Not the fancy types. Straightforward carpets. Woven for H&M, IKEA, Macy's, you know, stores like that in the West. And that's where they bought them from. They were throw rugs, they were children's nursery, you know, all kinds of places they use those carpets. You go to Moradabad, you have brassware. Again, linked to the international market. So here is this poor weaver sitting in a dugout loom in a distant village in Bhadohi, in a darkened hut, a rude cottage, weaving on his carpet on wool supplied to him by some intermediary of the main contractor. And this carpet is going to some place in Stockholm. You know? And this is the connection really. So when you talk about globalization, it is true. It has gone down all the way. But it has not changed the methods of production. It has actually deepened the old forms of production. It has not changed informal labor. It has only exaggerated the importance of informal labor. And why is that so? As I realized through the audit work, I realized that our edge in the international marketplace is because we produce cheap goods. And because we produce cheap goods, we outdo the others in the market in terms of making carpets, bric-a-brac, whatever, you know, automotive parts. You know, in Delhi, you live in Delhi, you go to Gurgaon or someplace, or even in Noida, you'll find many automobile part manufacturers. You would think that these are skilled laborers, but they're not. What happens really is this, that I have some money, I go to Germany, Japan, China, increasingly China, and I buy machines from there, I bring the machines over, I hire some skilled laborers who know temperature control, et cetera, circuitry, and then I put all the informal laborers to work. Why? Why? Because these machines are so darn good, they don't make a mistake. The machines don't make an error. And all you need to do is how to just learn how to operate them. I've been to huge, textile firms where you have a tailor on the job, and tailoring was till very recently a skilled job, but now all you need to do is to be able to hold the cloth straight, and the machine does the rest. You change the knob, the machine makes buttons. Change the knob, the machine makes pleats for curtains. Change the knob, the machine makes pillowcases. It's the machine that does it. So you don't really need very skilled labor. Some skilled labor you do need is if you're a glass blower, for example, or if you're a master dyer, when you're making the dye. Otherwise, you don't really need skilled labor of any kind. The machines are one that do the job. And this is why, by importing those machines, we are able to use our cheap labor to make things like I told you just now, in order to make a killing in the international marketplace. What are the things that we produce? We produce 38% straight away of our growth in terms of foreign exchange was from the MSEs, the medium and small enterprises. And this is the official understanding. But when I look at the figures of the Reserve Bank, I plot the figures down and I find in these industries, which are primarily small scale industries, they're producing for export, about 38% of foreign exchange comes from there. But that's not the full story. Arjun Sengupta, the late Arjun Sengupta, headed a commission on unorganized workers, a Government of India commission, by the way. He was a member of parliament of the Congress, and he came out with figures which embarrassed the government no end. You know what he found? And pay attention to these figures, they're very, very interesting. In 1999, 37.8% of all inputs in the organized sector came from the unorganized sector. By 2004, how many years? 5 years? 37.8% became 46.6%. So, as liberalization increased, as globalization increased, so did informal labor increase. Informal labor did not increase only in the small scale sector, not only in village dugout looms, but also in the organized sector. So the organized sector was using more and more from the informal sector. In fact, Bhargav, who is the chairman of Maruti, said in a candid moment just after the strike in Maruti that, we began life in Maruti like a Japanese company. Then we saw around us everybody was doing it differently and making more money by hiring informal labor and by getting into contract arrangement. So we said, we're not that dumb. We can do the same thing. So we moved on from being Japanese to being Indian. And today, 85%, he said, of our workforce is contract labor. So this is how the two are progressing side by side. So you have liberalization, you have globalization, but at the same time, paradoxically, you also have this large presence of informal labor. Units that employ less than 10 people. That number has grown up, gone by 110% between 1980 and 2005. Small units that employ less than 10 people, that number has grown up tremendously. Now, in 1960, we were producing 5 billion square meters of cloth. By the time 2006-07 came around, we were producing 26 billion square meters of cloth, from 5 to 26, right? But 80% of this increase happened in the loom sector, not the mill sector. So this huge increase in textile production again is happening in the small and medium enterprises where, it stands to reason. If you take one look at these spaces, almost all of them are informal laborers. And what does informal labor mean? Unskilled, unregistered, lowly paid, and most important, all the PFESI that they're supposed to get legally doesn't really reach them because they move from contractor to contractor and nobody can keep track of where they've gone. So this is the level of, shall we say, informalization that has taken place even in the formal sector. Levels of informalization taking place even in those areas which are exporting areas. In exporting areas, in fact, the informalization of labor is much more salient than in any other sector. And this is a truth which we have to recognize. And where are the informal laborers coming from? They're coming from these trade regions. Why don't they come as informal labor? Why don't they get trained on the way? Is because most of these industries don't actually need trained laborers. They don't actually need them. So when I have a discussion sometimes with these people in government authority, and they say we're going to open so many vocational schools, etc., etc., that's all very well. But where are they going to get a job? You must remember that unless there is a demand for that, it will not be produced. My carpenter, not my plumber, believe me, has a degree from the ITI. And he sits on his haunches near the market by my house with a cell phone, waiting for someone to call him, and then he'll go there and work. That's all he does. But he is an ITI degree holder. And that is really quite a tragedy. However, the fact of the matter is that there is no room for these people. No room for skilled labor, at least. What we need is lots of unskilled labor, because this is the kind of thing they produce. And these unskilled laborers are coming from the village. And interestingly enough, the bulk of them are dying to leave the village and would be much happier if they got a spot in some slum somewhere. Let's go back to the East UP story, because I saw this carpet weave, because I went there to study carpet weaving and agriculture and relationship between the two. And you know, there were village after village in certain times of the year where you hardly find any able-bodied man in the age group, say 20, 21 to 45, 50, you know, hardly. Then I came across two villages, one in Namnagar district or block, and I found all these, you know, big unshaven people standing around. So I said, well, what are you doing here? And they said, we are farmers. And by now I'm smart, you know, so I know you're not a farmer. What else are you? So on inquiry, naturally, it comes out that we are carpet weavers, the penny drops. So then I asked them this question that, when did you learn weaving carpets? And they said, when I was 9 or 10 years, 11 years old. Who taught you? My father taught me. Why did he teach you? Simple. Agriculture is uncertain, so you must have something to fall back on, you know, like a second string to your bow. That was it. So then I asked a question which turned out to be really a killer question. And I didn't know it was going to be a killer question. It's the most normal question anybody would ask. And the question was, have you taught your children to weave carpets? And you must believe me, 100% of them said no. We have not taught our children to weave carpets. We don't want them to be carpet weavers. Look where it has brought us. And what were the boys doing? They were not doing arithmetic or English or whatever. They were kicking stones, whistling, hands in the pocket, but they will not weave carpets. All they're waiting for is they're looking beyond their mud walls, if some signal will beam from some distant shore and take them away, you know, from the village to somewhere else. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. So when people leave the village, they don't leave the village like in the movies that you buy a ticket and enter Bombay. They leave the village when the network already at work. Somebody somewhere is calling out to them. There is a network that will support them in the moments of transition, because the vicissitudes of urban life and non-rural life can be quite demanding. So you are therefore left with a large number of old people in villages. So this initial manpower study tells us that normally you would say that 42% of villagers are cultivators in the most generous sense, okay? But even that most generous sense, if you were to look at it in terms of age group, when it is 60% plus, the percent of cultivators goes up from 43 to 63%. 20% jump straight away when you take the age group 60 plus, which means that most people are staying, old people staying back in the village, looking after their handkerchief-sized plot, so that young people can go out and do something else. Now, if you were to go to village today, you'd find the levels of aspirations are most impressive. And this is why I feel that the kind of stuff we did earlier, like Antyodaya program, even the MNREGA, Manrega program, they seem to miss the point. These programs are very good in terms of felt need of the villages, poor people. But I think the poor in India have moved away from that kind of thing, and they have now aspirations. And I think what you need to do is to address felt aspirations, not felt needs, because people actually have aspirations. Now the village is not what it used to be. It is not repeating itself in the same dull, you know, monochromatic way. It's different. As I told you, most of the villagers today, many of them at least, are not working on land at all, though they call themselves farmers. They're not working on land. So things are changing rapidly. Alongside with that, you have parents who are saying, we will not teach our children to weave carpets. Things are moving. What do they want to do? If you ask women in villages, which I used to ask women in villages through other women, of course, and what do you want for children? They'll always say, we want a school. You ask a man, he'll say, we want a factory. But maybe they're saying the same things in different ways. I don't know. I think women think much more long-term and more comprehensively. I think men think in more focused terms, you know, let's have a job for today's bread and stuff like that. But this aspiration is important because the number of children who now go to school, we know the literacy figures are going up. Okay, we also know through various studies that though kids go to school, they're not that well schooled. You know, they don't know certain basics. The latest figures say the 8 to 11 age group children, about 60% in public schools and 40% in private schools, cannot do simple three-digit subtraction and do not recognize a simple sentence like my mother's name is Moti Ben. You know, so that is very bad. But what is makes it more tragic is this. That when in 1980, when the survey was done, 2% of Indian kids went to private schools. Only 2%. I'm not sure that I know the breakup, rural and urban. I imagine most of them must have been urban. But today, in the 2010-11 Human Development Index study shows, and this is what I believe in because I've seen it myself, that 21% of rural kids, 51% of urban kids go to private schools. 2%, 1980, the other day, you know. We were still young, you know, when that happened in 1980. And what, 30 years? And look at the change. Amazing change, you know. The ground has just vanished from under our feet. 2%, 21%, and 51%. Incredible. And where are these kids going? To private school? What kind of private school? Not the kind that you go to or you know of. Very simple, rude private schools in a room half this size, you know. The teacher gets paid below minimum wages, 800, 1,500, that's about it. The only difference is the teacher turns up to class, you know. And that's why they go to private schools. I know of two, only two, I confess, but I know of two BPL families that actually send their children to a private school, you know. And they're really BPL because they are really, really poor. But whatever they can manage, this is 2005 story, they somehow wrestle together 40 rupees to send their kids to a private school. So they keep tightening their belt, tightening their belt, tightening their belt. And then, what? It's just the buckle left. There's no belt, you know. But they send their children to private school. That is the level of aspiration. They want the kids to get out. They want them to do something else, you know, from what others have been doing. So the village today is not repeating itself. The village wants to break free. But it's not easy, as you know. And when they break free, they migrate. And where do they migrate? They migrate to towns. And for the first time in 2011 census, for the first time, the increase in urban population has pipped the increase in rural population. Urban population has grown by 91 million, and the rural population has grown by 90.7 million between 2001 and 2011. You know, if you look at it in terms of percentage, it's more dramatic. Percentage-wise, 13% increase in rural India population and 31% increase in urban India population. So now, for the first time, not only is the increase in urban population more than the increase in rural population, as you know, some Tatta mentioned to you, that about 30% roughly of India is officially rural. Officially urban, 70% officially rural. But you take a close look, and what is rural is not so rural after all, as I was explaining to you right now. But even so, the increase in population is quite dramatic, you know. And that tells you another way, 18 new, in the last 10 years, 18 new million plus cities have come up. 72 new class 1 towns have come up. 2,773 new towns have come up. All the last 10 years. And what are happening in these towns? They're buzzing with economic activity. This is where the action is. So you see, Delhi's population growth has slipped from 52% to 26%. Bombay's from 31% to roughly 14 or 15%, I forget. Gone down. If you look at Bombay proper and Delhi proper, then in fact the population is now stable, Bombay is decreased. But Bombay metropolitan region and national capital region, that has increased. But these areas have stabilized. But where is the where are the numbers growing? The numbers are growing in small towns. Loni. Have you heard of Loni? I bet you haven't. 110% increase in Loni. In Noida, which you know of course, you know, 75% increase. Gurgaon, 68% increase. Ghaziabad, 43%. Meerut, 52%, you know, percent increase in population. But Big cities are stabilizing, small cities are growing very, very rapidly. You don't you just look at the map and you'll find the places like Erode, you know, in South India, Coimbatore, Tirupur, all these places are growing rapidly. Tirupur is the hosiery capital. It's one dump, you know, not more than that. And it has got 6 ports feeding it with cotton. It doesn't grow any cotton over there. I did a study of cotton farming in India and Pakistan, and I didn't find a single cotton-growing village in that region. It's all fed by ports from outside. And there you are, it's growing rapidly. Well, how do you explain it? You explain it only by this, that today, if I've got a pot of money, I'd be a fool to do 2 things. I'd be a fool to have organized labor, right? Everybody else is unorganized labor. As Bhargav said, he was a fool when he started by adopting the Japanese model. I'd be a fool to have organized labor. I'd have unorganized labor, you know, informal labor. And I'd also be a fool to set up an industry factory in Delhi because real estate prices are through the roof. So I'll set up my factory, my industry in some place far away. And now that I have the internet, I don't need banks. All I need is real estate and I need cheap labor, and that's not available in Delhi, it's available elsewhere. That is why I go elsewhere. That is why the small towns are growing so rapidly. That is why even white-collar jobs are growing in small towns than in big towns. Take a look at this. ASSOCHAM study. ASSOCHAM, you know ASSOCHAM? Association Chamber of Commerce. ASSOCHAM did a study and they found that in a place like Lucknow, in Delhi, Bombay, Chennai, the openings for white-collar jobs are really, really, really limited. In my auditing days, I used to often go with these company bosses on a hiring spree, and they never went to IIM Ahmedabad or wherever. They used to go to Madurai Institute of Technology or Bulandshahr Management Institute, because they said that we don't need very skilled people. We don't need people who speak English. We just need somebody who knows the job and has a great deal of commitment. We're going to give him an air-conditioned office, a tie to wear, and a taxi to back and forth from his home. That's all. And they're very, very happy. So white-collar jobs are coming up more in these small towns than in big towns. So Lucknow, for example, you have over 53% increase in number of white-collar jobs. Allahabad, 100% increase. Well, okay, 64% increase in white-collar jobs in a town like Patiala. But will you believe it? 127% increase in Hoshiarpur when it comes to white-collar jobs. So this is where the action is happening. So I thought all this time that village India is changing. But by God, urban India is changing even more, you know. And I never paid attention to it. I was sitting right here. I never paid attention to it. Urban India is changing more, not under my nose, but changing more just outside my reach in the small towns. And if you go to the small towns, you see it happening. As I told you, white-collar jobs, informal labor, all of that is happening not in metropolitan centers anymore. You know, till 1991, the argument was, of all the demographers, that metropolitan areas attract the most migrants. Today, those demographers have to completely abandon their earlier notions, and they will now say that it is not the metropolitan areas, it's the small towns, and the reason is simply this. Earlier, you needed banks, you needed skilled labor, etc., etc. Now, you don't need any of that. You have a computer, you have a nice car that can go through bumpy roads, you go there twice a week, rest of the time the truck goes back and forth, and you're fine. Have you heard of a man called Sanjay Ghodawat? No. Sanjay Ghodawat lives in a place called Manikpur. Have you heard of it? No. Manikpur is very close to another place, small little place called Sholapur. Have you heard of it? Yes. Now, Sholapur is the biggest town in that area. Can you imagine? And Sanjay Ghodawat makes his billions and zillions out there. What did he start off with? Making good cars, and then he now makes turbines. He has 121 cars. And every morning he is in trouble. He doesn't know which car to take to work. So he takes a helicopter instead. You know? That man works in a small town. 21% of India's billionaires come from small towns. All right. Now the final, you know, finishing touches is this. If you want to know where the action is really happening today, it's happening in villages, in workshops, worksheds, happening in small units that employ less than 10 workers. Lots of men are moving from village to village. A migration, not just village to city. There's a lot of migration happening from village to village. And you can only understand that in terms of marriage, but that's the women marrying. But when men move, men are moving from this village to that village in search of a rural workshop and getting a job there, or moving from village to small town. Now, very rarely do they move to big cities. As I told you, the population figures are not increasing that rapidly. But, you know, the ultimate test of this all is to see, where are the slums growing? The slums are also growing in small towns. Pune was once a small town, right? Between 1991 and 2007, Pune's slum population growth has been 176%. Now try to beat that. Surat, the slum population growth doubled in 1983 and 1991. Tough to beat, isn't it? Faridabad, 46%, Meerut 43%, Delhi 21%. So Faridabad and Meerut have more slum population percentage-wise than Delhi has. So slum population is an index, is a proxy of where the action is happening. People are moving from village to small town and small town to slums. So don't associate slums any longer with big cities, you know, with Do Bigha Zameen of the old Balraj Sahni type. Slums are happening in small towns, right there. And this is why you have a completely new urban landscape, an urban landscape that none of our earlier conceptual, you know, apparatuses would help us understand. We have to not only abandon the rural understanding of what is a villager, what is a farmer, what is rural non-farm employment, we often know that. But alongside with that, we find the rural and the urban are so closely intertwined. That person who works in a village workshop could easily be working in Meerut instead. You know, or in Loni, or in Tirupur. The same thing. It depends on where the location is. And so much of that is happening in small towns outside the purview of big cities that we tend to not notice them. What do we notice? We notice the IT sector. The IT sector, ITES sector, IT and IT-enabled sector, together, and this is a figure from the NASSCOM, together employ less than 2 million people. That's it. Together they employ less than 2 million people. But because these 2 million are people we know, these 2 million drive cars past us. Therefore, they are much more visible to our eye. But they're only 2 million people. On the other hand, 93% of our workforce is in the informal sector. Not just agriculture, but also the kind I mentioned to you. And this informal sector labor, by the way, is what is linking us very closely to the global market. And we have to understand these two together to be able to figure out what are the changes taking place in contemporary India. Because these changes will impact the nature of rural mobilization. It's not at all like what it used to be. It will impact on caste relationships. Why? Because people are now free to leave the village. So caste relationships will also change. It will impact family ties a great deal. Because I told you earlier, now very often you have just the old people at home. You talk to any taxi driver here and you ask them, where your parents, and they'll say mummy papa ghar pe hai, you know, and there may be one brother, either the old brother or the idiot brother, you know, is there. Otherwise they're all out. And this is the story you'll hear from person to person urban India. So all of that I told you will also impact your hardcore sociology, impact your caste study, impact your family study, impact your urban studies, of course. It'll also impact your rural mobilization studies. All of them will impact, and you understand them better, I think, much more acutely, if you figure out and come out of this denial, figure out the relationship between urban and rural, and come out of the denial that urban and rural India should proceed along the same old track. They are not doing it that way, and they are, in fact, refusing to obey academic literature. Thank you. Okay.